On our trip away for Tracy's birthday this week, we drove past Gloucester Academy. And like many schools, it had its motto written on the board outside the gate. The motto is short and memorable. It's just four words. It says this: work hard, be kind. Work hard, be kind. As mottos go, I guess it's okay. I can't really fault either of the sentiments. Working hard is indeed good, a moral thing to do. And whilst it can't guarantee you success in life, the opposite, being lazy and not applying yourself, will almost certainly be a road to misery and pain. And the second half of it, be kind. Again, that's not something I'm really going to argue with. Obviously, how we relate to other humans is really important, isn't it? So, work hard, be kind. Sure. But could we do better if we were looking for a motto for life? Is there greater, is there better wisdom that will have a more transformative effect on our lives? I want to say to you, yes, there is. And in the passage that Rachel just read to us, there is such a transformative statement. More than a motto, I think 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, if properly understood and lived, could radically alter, could spectacularly transform your life. Are you intrigued? You see, the problem with the words "be kind" is that they miss out one really big, really huge relationship where we need to learn how to behave properly. Even more important than our behavior towards one another, our behavior towards God is the most important thing. And that's what verse 6 deals with. So this morning, I want us to think about these two verses that make up this better way to live by asking you two questions. Here's my first question. Do you live under God's authority? Do you live under God's authority? The first half of verse 6 says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. The way Peter writes this instruction in the original language is for us to humble ourselves. This has the sense of us responding to something outside of ourselves. This isn't an action that you generate yourself. It's a reaction that he's talking about. We're not self-starting something new here. If this was an active instruction, it would be like starting with a blank canvas, a green field site. Imagine an empty plot of land, and then you get to work with an architect to imagine and then build exactly the kind of house that you want. You're totally free to decide what you build. That's not what Peter is saying here. This isn't something you're doing. This is more like you're buying an old Victorian house that needs doing up. And so you're going to need to restore it, respecting its style and its age. You don't go slapping in modern IKEA fixtures and fittings. Instead, you retain and use the brass fittings and the cast iron fireplaces. You do it up, respecting what's already there. You respond appropriately to something that already exists. And so we might better understand Peter here by switching the order of the words. And we could say this: knowing that God has a mighty hand, humility is our right and proper response. Can you see? Humility is a response to God and how mighty he is. Does God the Father have a real hand? Well, of course not. God is a spirit. He doesn't have a body as such. And yet God often describes himself with human characteristics so as to better relate, to better communicate with us. The Old Testament is full of language like the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, or because of my mighty hand, Pharaoh will let them go. God often uses this picture language. In fact, this is code language to tell us that God is significant, that he is important, that you need to reckon with him, not dismiss him. He's the boxer that has won every fight he's ever entered. He's a powerful force to be reckoned with, to be taken seriously. He is all powerful. He is almighty. He is all knowing. This expression, the hand of God, encapsulates that power, protection, deliverance, justice, guidance, provision, and miraculous works of God. It's calling on us to trust in God's sovereignty, to remain humble before a mighty being, and to rely on his strength in all circumstances. Which is a pretty big challenge, isn't it? You don't have to watch the news or be around people for very long to realize that there's a pretty big shortage of humility these days. Humility is often misunderstood as weakness. And nobody wants to be weak, do they? So we avoid humility like the plague. Our ego wants to be respected. Peter knows this. Peter, the author of this letter, he was, after all, an alpha male himself. He was a strong, burly fisherman. He was used to being out in storms on the water or fishing all night. He was a proper Yorkshire-style grafter, somebody who took care of his family and his friends. That was Peter. And yet here, older, wiser, Christian Peter gives us the last instruction we ever expected from him. Here he is speaking about consciously humbling ourselves and putting ourselves under God's authority. Not kicking against it, which, let's face it, is what every human heart is naturally wired to do all of the time. Peter's not so much making a comment about God as exposing the rebellious nature of our human hearts. That's right, isn't it? As you sit there quietly and respectfully listening to me this morning, take a look into your own heart. Do you hate being told what to do? Do you hate being overlooked? Do you want people to like you, to laugh at your jokes, and care about you? Do you want to be a successful somebody rather than an obscure nobody? That's our natural, sinful human nature. It says, my ideas, my needs are more important than you. Inside every one of us lives a hidden Bond villain seeking power and influence and, yes, why not, untold luxury. Armies of people doing our bidding. Anything and everything we want brought to us on a plate. Forever. And lots of us will stop at nothing to achieve it or die trying. If you think I'm exaggerating, look at the billionaires of the world. Are they satisfied, happy people? Or do they want even more? And will they stop at nothing to get it? Let's face it, Elon Musk is not a nice person, is he? And there, but for the grace of God, go I. Be very thankful that you are not rich. Or, bring it closer to home, have you seen the trend for people these days to want a blog or an Instagram following. Anyone and everyone, it seems, has a YouTube channel. And we measure our successes, our impact, with how many likes or views or subscribers that we get. Back in 2022, couldn't find more recent stats, but go with it. Back in 2022, this is astonishing, right? Every minute of every day, 500 more hours of video are uploaded to YouTube. You can't possibly watch them all. There are over 114 million active YouTube channels, which means, I did the math, one in 70 people in the whole world has a YouTube channel. It's astonishing, isn't it? If you live on a street of 35 houses, odds are that one of your neighbours has a YouTube channel. Craving subscriptions and likes and follows. And that's just one way our hearts express this craving. There are so many other ways that we crave attention and success and prominence and value in society. No wonder Peter needs to give us a stern command to humble ourselves under God's mighty hand. Speaking of the perfect worlds of YouTube and Instagram, we all know the real world isn't like that. It's full of bad stuff, stuff that goes wrong, whether we're a Christian or not. What do we do with that? How do we cope when the sudden bereavement of a family member happens, or a close friend dies, or that notice of redundancy comes, that home burglary when you're away on holiday, that cancer diagnosis? Often, when hardship and suffering come into our lives, we react pretty badly. Is it too much to say that our default reaction to suffering is not very humble? What are non-humble ways of responding to suffering? Pushing back? Shaking your metaphorical fist at God? Raging against your hard providences? It's not fair that you're treating me like this, God. Maybe the extreme response is even to reject him and to say, well, I'm not going to follow a God who treats me like this. Stop for a moment and think back to the last big time of challenge you faced in your life. How did your heart react? Did you blame God? Did you want the suffering to stop? Did you wonder why, if God loved you, that he was making you endure something that you would have stopped in a heartbeat if you were him? More humility here will help us see that suffering is a providence from God, not a punishment for sins, but as a reminder of the sinful brokenness of the world. Are you shocked to learn that God often intentionally brings suffering into our lives? He often uses this as a chastening instrument to make us more like Jesus, or to draw us to Jesus if we're not yet a follower. Suffering exists primarily to make followers of Jesus more Christ-like. One thing especially that suffering helps remove from us is the idolization of comfort. Have you noticed everything today is about comfort? John Ortberg nails both our hearts and our society's constant obsession to chase comfort when he writes this. To be a follower of Jesus, you must renounce comfort as the ultimate value in your life. That's astonishing, isn't it? But it's true. I ask you this morning, is a desire for comfort getting in the way of your discipleship? And here's the cold, hard truth about how circumstances can challenge our desire for comfort. Even the small challenges do that. Even, perhaps especially, it's the small things that really test our belief that God is sovereign. The seemingly random stuff that happens. The flat tire when you're leaving for work. The traffic jam on the way to an appointment. The unexpectedly closed shop after you make that special trip. The forecast of a rainy Saturday when you really wanted to go walking in the Lake District. When these things happen to us, how do we react? Do we calmly submit ourselves to the mighty hand of God? Or do we bristle and complain and rage and grumble? And before you wonder if your preachers are more humble than you are, all of those examples come from my personal experience. Here's a golden truth that you need to remember and to repeat to yourselves day after day. God gives us affliction so that we will give ourselves to God. That's the humility that Peter is urging you to have. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. And verse 6 goes on to say, so that he may exalt you at the proper time. That's the motivation you need to help you kill pride and ego and submit to God to become a nobody. Because actually with God, nobody's a nobody. Everybody's a somebody when you have Jesus. Because God will lift you up at the proper time. Note, his time, not your time. And for some people, that will be in this life, for sure. Sometimes God exalts some of his followers into positions of great power and influence, the better to demonstrate the power and the truth of the gospel. Sometimes those people are Christian preachers. Other times they are Christians in prominent positions of great authority or influence. Maybe a political leader. Maybe a great sportsman or a scientist. I guess all of us maybe knows a famous Christian politician or is a favorite Christian sports personality. Somebody known for their Christian virtue. Somebody God will use to show many people the love and the gospel of Jesus. But that's not everybody, is it? And if we're honest, that's probably not going to be you or I. Statistically speaking, you'll probably live a life of relative obscurity. You won't become famous, and you'll die in obscurity outside of a small circle of family and friends. And you'll probably be forgotten within a few decades of your death. Most people do, and that's just the reality of life. But before I depress you too much, what about Christian hope? Christian hope is not uncertain and vague like the hope of the world. Rather, it's secure and it's certain and it's promised to every single one of Jesus' followers if you faithfully follow Jesus to the end. Let me read you some encouragement from Revelation. Revelation 2:10 says this, "Be faithful unto death and I will give you the crown of life." Astonishing. 2 Timothy 2:11-12 says, if we have died with him, we will also live with him. If we endure, we will also reign with him. Christian, one day, if you are faithful to the end, you will reign with Jesus. Don't worry about being a nobody in this life. 2 Corinthians 4:17 says, for this light and momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond comparison. Think of all the riches and comfort of this world. It pales into insignificance for what you will have in heaven. Be encouraged. One thing is sure and certain. Even if you are humbled and overlooked for all of this life. In the new creation, you will have status and honor and glory as God exalts you at the proper time. Trust him for that and don't seek it out for yourselves. In fact, this is the major theme of Peter's letter. Peter often repeats similar thoughts. We who follow Jesus are living for a distant land. We are called to be travelers, not at home in this world. We are to live counterculturally, casting off the bragging and the self-promotion that this world's culture demands of us. And instead, model the same attitude that Jesus had. 1 Peter 2:22 to 25 tells us what that was. He did not commit sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When he was insulted, he did not insult in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that having died to sins, we might live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but you have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Look, if Jesus did all of that for you, what have you got left to brag about? Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that he might exalt you at the proper time. Are you living under God's authority? That's my first question. My second question is, and this is briefer, do you live under God's care? Do you live under God's care? Verse 7 says, casting all your cares on him because he cares for you. Here is the root of the challenge of trying to care for ourselves. We can't. Self-care, self-help is doomed to failure because fundamentally we are the problem. No amount of counseling or self-actualization will fix you. Now, don't mishear me. I'm not saying that we shouldn't care about our mental health. I'm not saying we shouldn't get treatment for clinical depression or PTSD or any one of a number of real and debilitating conditions that might affect us as a result of living in a cursed world. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is we cannot ultimately fix ourselves because our minds aren't the problem. Problem's not here, problem's here, in your heart. Christianity isn't your golden ticket to a life without stress and problems. The gospel isn't a manual for those seeking a self-improvement project. The kingdom of heaven is for those who know how to die. The gospel makes us gloriously free to be the nobodies that we really are. It's not about us, it's about Jesus. He frees us so that we can lose ourselves in him. He's the righteousness we need, so you don't have to strive for it. He's the obedience we cannot be, so you don't have to worry. He's the righteousness we must obtain if we are to be acceptable to God. None of that comes from you or your works. Have you seen and understood that? You can't self-care. And the sooner you realize, the more likely you are to throw yourselves on the mercy of the Son of God. You are, the Bible uses a stronger word for this, but because of sensibilities, I'll use the translated word. You are dung, and all your righteousness is like filthy rags. And do you hear your spirit, your heart going, but surely there's some good in me. I'm not that bad, am I? I'm not as bad as some other people. Surely there's some good. We like to depend on ourselves. We like to imagine that we have some resources and some skills and some capabilities that will sustain us and help us, at least most of the time in everyday life. Is that the gospel? Trust Jesus and try your best? Nope. Your faith is not an emergency poncho you get out when the thunderstorm breaks. It's not an insurance policy you keep in a drawer only to get out when the pipes burst or you crash the car. You don't get to be a Christian with all the power and the capability most of the time and just lean on Jesus when the times of testing and trouble come. That's not how the Christian life works. I urge you, resolve today to turn your back on that way of living. What should you do instead? You've got to cast yourselves on Jesus all the time, every day, for everything. That's how the kingdom of God works. Anything you do in your own strength is destined to fail. I don't think we believe that, do we? I don't believe that. I don't really believe it. I believe it in my head, but my actions say otherwise. Everything I do in my own strength is destined to fail. Do you remember the incident in Mark chapter 10 when some people brought children to Jesus and the disciples tried to shoo them away? He's doing important things like teaching people doctrine. Take the children away. They don't understand. Jesus told them off and he encouraged the children to come to him for blessing. And then Jesus says a really quite shocking thing. It's in Mark 10 and verse 15. Truly, I tell you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it. Let me ask you a question. And we've got some examples this morning. If you need a thought experiment to focus your thinking. Have you ever met a little child who knows how to take care of themselves? Think about little Lavinia. Can she earn money? Can she do the shopping? Can she buy a house? Can she change her own nappy? They can't even dress themselves. They can't do anything for themselves. They need constant care, and they need to constantly throw themselves on the help of their parents. And they don't have to think about it. They just do it naturally, instinctively. Well, says Peter, we ought to constantly throw ourselves onto our spiritual father. We need to learn to do this naturally, instinctively, rejecting our own strength and our own wisdom. For sure, we are actually grown-ups, and as such, we do have a calling, we do have a mission, and we do have work to do, but you'll likely screw that up on a regular basis, because very likely you'll do lots of it in your own strength. Yes, just like Peter, he knows what it's like, because he denied Jesus just at his very hour of need. Just after he had been protesting that he would defend Jesus to the death. Three times. Look, we're all Peter when you scrape off the layer of respectability and Western social righteousness. Here's the truth that I think you already know. God uses sinners to build his kingdom so that all the glory goes to him. You don't get the credit. I don't get the credit. In fact, you must not take the credit. At the end of the day, after you serve to the best of your abilities, you're just an unworthy servant. You don't bring anything to the party. It's all about Jesus. So, cast your cares on him. because he knows how to care for you. When you get that and you understand it fully, it's tremendously liberating. That mistake you made, all part of the sovereign and gracious plan. Confess it, get rid of the guilt, and learn the humility that God has designed that episode to teach you. Do you see how well linked the two verses of our text are? They basically flow from the same root thought. This can be a real help for us practically. That conversation or opportunity or relationship that promises so much and delivers so little, our natural man wants to use that as an excuse to give up or to think that God isn't really in control of everything or that he doesn't care enough about you and your little life. Fight those thoughts with this passage. Accept the providence of God and understand that your timing is not his timing. And cast yourselves into the caring arms of King Jesus because he cares for you. Peter's not going out on a difficult limb here. He's just reminding us of a truth that he himself heard from the very lips of Jesus himself. Jesus knows all about your trouble and concern, and Jesus doesn't want you to be over anxious. Jesus said in Matthew 6:25, do not worry about your life. God's in charge, he's powerful, and he cares about you. Peter wants us to rely on God's care and provision in every aspect of our lives. He invites you to practice humility, not only in your interactions with others or in your reactions to life circumstances, but also in your daily trust in God's goodness and faithfulness. Jesus knows and Jesus has got you. The gospel sets you free. So don't voluntarily pick up again the yoke of slavery. Instead, yoke yourself to Jesus because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. And when you come to him and learn from him, you discover that he is lowly and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. After denial and heartache and self-reliance, this is the truth that Peter has finally learned after all those years. And this morning, he's inviting you to learn it also. Can you do that? Can you humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God so that he may exalt you in the proper time, casting all your cares on him because he cares for you.